The Information's 411 is brought to you by Brex, the company that's reimagining financial systems to power the next generation of business. Check them out at brex.com/the information. If you use a computer to do work, you will no doubt have strong feelings about the software you're using to do it. And more likely than not, during the pandemic, you've been introduced to a slew of new apps, including Zoom, Teams, or Slack, and many other apps for project management or collaboration. And if your company has a consumer-facing website or operates internal apps for employees, it has increasingly relied on the cloud to power them. And to build that website or internal app, it's needed software engineers. That's where startups come in. Welcome to The Information 50, our annual look at the most promising startups worth less than $1 billion and that you probably haven't heard of. My name is Amir Efrati, executive editor at The Information, and today we're talking about B2B, otherwise known as enterprise software startups. And more than half of the companies on our list this year reflect two big pandemic-related trends in the tech industry. Companies trying to control spending on all of those subscription software apps that they now pay for, and their constant search for new employees or engineers. Two other startups on our list develop tools to help developers manage corporate apps that run on public cloud providers like AWS and Azure. I'll be talking to Kevin McLaughlin, who helped me report on and vet these companies, which ended up making our cut. And later, I'll be speaking to Jonathan Siddharth, founder and CEO of the number one pick on our list, Turing, which helps companies hire pre-vetted remote engineers based all over the world. Just 3 years old, Turing already is on pace to generate more than $20 million in revenue, and its employee base grew by 8 times during the pandemic, and it now counts Coinbase, Johnson & Johnson, Rivian, Dell, and Pepsi as active customers. But first up, here's Kevin. Okay, Kevin, let's talk about enterprise software. We have a lot of companies on our list this year in a variety of areas, but all really jumping on pandemic-related trends. Can you tell us about the different categories of enterprise software companies that we focused on our list this year?
Yes. Last year, we had, I think, eight or most of the companies on our list last year were either companies that helped manage data or ones that helped other companies get a look into how their applications were performing on cloud providers. This year, there's a pretty good breakup of, for example, we have two companies that Turing and Seekout, which help other companies find and recruit talent, whether that's engineering talent and other types of talent. Obviously, this is one of the big themes of our moment that we're living in with the Great Resignation and people moving around, and companies have always been looking for engineering talent, but never more so than now. And then we also had two companies that also reflect the trend of during the pandemic, companies buying lots of SaaS applications in order to quickly equip remote workers with various business functions and things like that. So we had Productive and we had Vendor. And these are two companies that are basically just helping companies keep track of the sprawl that happens when different departments have made these purchases and perhaps didn't coordinate centrally with their IT departments. Another thing these companies do, which is also important, is sometimes a department will sign up and start using an app, and then for whatever reason, they might not use it as much as they were. And meanwhile, the renewal comes up after a year or however many months. And using this type of software, companies can know, hey, are these applications being used? And if so, at what rate? Do we need to buy as many seats as we did last year? And, you know, when you are talking about a large company with thousands of employees, these costs add up pretty quickly. And so they were two. I think that was maybe the one area of this list that I was kind of surprised by, because I didn't expect to see the pandemic impact reflected so quickly. And obviously, these companies existed before the pandemic, But talk about timing, at least. They definitely had good timing.
Both of them started in 2018. Vendor is V-E-N-D-R, lovely spelling. Productive is like the word productive without the E, but Vendor is already on pace to generate $16 million this year. And these companies, and maybe Vendor in particular, just seems to be a very well-placed strategically in terms of being between big software vendors and their customers. Let's talk about another category of company that seems particularly apt for the moment, this era of increasing concerns about privacy and data, this era of whistleblowers, this era of ransomware attacks that are ravaging companies much more than is being disclosed. Can you talk a little bit about two of the companies here on our list that made it this year, Privacera and Teleport, that kind of speak to this?
Sure. Privacera and Teleport are really a reflection broadly of the fact that companies have so much data coming in from various sources, whether that's generated by applications or sensor devices or what have you. And in a lot of cases, the data comes in at a faster rate than they can sort of keep track of it. And so it's very important when you have lots of employees to make sure that people that are logging in don't accidentally get access to, you know, the HR system with everyone's salaries on it. I mean, that's an age-old example, but the problems these days are much more granular than that. But I think it definitely does, you know, reflect this challenge that companies have, where security software isn't enough. You have to also have identity and access management, which obviously is not a new thing, but it's getting more important, as you said, when you have all these different threat vectors that perhaps didn't exist before or weren't as pronounced as they are now.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about one of our favorite topics, which is microservices. And in general, the challenges of running applications on, you know, cloud providers and so on. I wanted to ask you about Temporal, which we are hearing a lot of buzz about. It's a Sequoia Capital backed company from the Seattle area. But can you talk about the companies on this list, including Temporal, that are kind of more squarely in the like cloud software management realm and what's happening there?
Similar in some ways to Kong, which was a company we featured on last year's list. This is all about the trend of building large applications that have multiple component parts, each of which are individually managed by different teams. And Temporal basically ensures, for example, if you have like an e-commerce or a banking application, there are probably at least a dozen different steps, or perhaps even more, that happen along the way, each of which is handled by a microservice. If one of the microservices during that process becomes congested due to network traffic or whatever, then it will. There's the possibility exists that the task might not complete, and that things will just hang. And what Temporal does is it ensures that when that happens, for whatever reason that a microservice gets hung up, that it will continue to retry or automatically try to find alternatives to basically keep trying until the task completes. And obviously for things like finance and transaction processing, that's a vital function. But it's also, I had no idea that this problem existed, but the microservices approach has made it possible to build larger and more complex applications and also make them more resistant to downtime and more resilient generally. Temporal comes in and is addressing one of the first kind of business problems that has arisen from that new technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, similar to the enterprise AI startup list that we worked on together, the kind of B2B or traditional enterprise software list was equally difficult to do, just because with very, very little revenue, companies are able to get 300x, 1000x kind of valuation multiples, depending on which investors they're talking to. So I think with at least some of the companies on our list, including Turing and Seekout, I think both of those are in the like $20 million annualized revenue kind of range. It's like just a matter of time before they kind of break into that unicorn realm quite easily. I think if they wanted to, there's so much competition to deploy capital into these on the chance that they'll one day break out and take off and become the next Snowflake or the next Accenture or the next generation version of those. So anyway, Kevin, thank you for the time. And next up, we're going to be interviewing Jonathan Siddharth, who's the CEO of Turing. We're going to talk all about remote work and acquiring talent in this day and age. So stay tuned. Today's episode is brought to you by Brex, the company that's reimagining financial systems to power the next generation of business. Brex knows that leaders and finance teams have heard it all. Disrupt the industry, banish mediocrity, dominate e-commerce. Well, Brex also knows that to do any of that, you first need a superior corporate card, one with 10 to 20 times higher credit limits, no personal guarantee, and built-in spend controls and expense tracking. Apply online at brex.com/theinformation, and you'll get up to 50,000 rewards points. That's brex.com/theinformation. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Amir, for having me.
So we've been talking for the better part of 2 years, I think, maybe even longer. I want to hear a little bit about how you started Turing and what it was like to be a provider of remote work services during the pandemic.
This may sound crazy, but the moment of inception for Turing was actually 2012. I remember that year distinctly because I was running my first startup. And for the first time, I thought I was going to fail. The company was actually at a critical point where we needed to raise a Series A. Every VC on Sand Hill was turning us down because although we had a lot of traffic on the web, they wanted to see mobile app traction, and we didn't have a mobile app out. I needed to hire an iOS and Android engineer fast. It was a moment, until that point, the thought that I could fail like never even crossed my mind, but at that time I was at my lowest. Every engineer that I was looking to hire from Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon was turning us down. It was costly to hire, hard to get them away from a FANG++ job. I realized that if I did not do something different, we were going to fail. So my co-founder and I made the decision to look beyond Silicon Valley to hire engineering talent and look in places where nobody was looking. And we were fortunate to find some incredible engineers from Ukraine, Poland, Serbia, and China. And that was really key for us. So we got these amazing engineers on board. We launched V1 of our iPhone app. Apple recognized it as one of the best apps for content recommendations. We raised our Series A successfully, and the company had a successful exit towards the end. And after Rover was sold, I took some time off in 2017 and early 2018 to recharge. I teamed up with my co-founder, Vijay, again, and we were figuring out what we wanted to build next. It was very clear that whatever company we were going to start, the first step was going to be to replicate what we'd done in our first startup, which was to look beyond Silicon Valley and find these amazing engineers in places where nobody was looking. And this was March 2018. At that time, I remember like when we were raising our seed round, there were VCs who would say, "Hey, if you're building a tech company, don't all the engineers need to be in one room?" And these last 2 years has just accelerated the pace of adoption of remote work. And we've definitely benefited from the world's shift to remote work. It's been really crazy this last year and a half with the growth that we've been seeing. And people's perception has just completely changed. No customer today asks us, When they come to us for an engineer, they don't ask us anymore where the engineer's based. And even in many geographies, it's become culturally more acceptable to be a remote worker. So we've benefited from these tailwinds around remote work. And it's been very exciting. We now live in a remote first world.
Is it possible that your personal background, not being from the US originally and having maybe a more global mindset, did that play into the idea behind the company as well? Or do you think it would have happened no matter where you came from?
So my personal background was a factor. I grew up in Chennai, which is a relatively smaller city in India. And growing up in Chennai, I realized there were exactly two companies you could work for, like if you wanted to stay in Chennai. One of them was Symantec. I don't remember the second one. It doesn't matter if you were top of your class in computer science, like whatever you did, that was kind of it, right? So to me, when I came to Stanford for grad school, I could see the gap, the opportunity gap, right? In the Bay Area and in the US in general, we're just privileged with how much abundance of opportunity we have. And a big part of our mission at Turing is to take this magic of Silicon Valley, this opportunity abundance that we have, and figure out a way to scale this planet-wide. What if every awesome engineer in the world had access to the same opportunity we take for granted, and they were not limited by the jobs that they could drive to with a car within 20 miles, right? It's such a waste of intellect and talent. And I hope that 10 years from now or 20 years from now, there's a future where there's a version of me that doesn't really have to move to the Bay Area or move to the US. Like wherever that person is born, they are able to contribute at exactly the same level that us in the Bay Area get to contribute. So it definitely opened my eyes to the opportunity gap. And you kind of, like growing up in these smaller towns, you kind of see really, really smart people, like very smart people. And you just see that they're not nearly as successful as some of the other people that you meet who just won the Geo lottery, right? And what if like everyone wins the Geo lottery? Like how magical would the world be? Like how many drugs would get discovered that don't get discovered today? How many new unicorns would exist that don't exist today? So it stuck with me.
I wanted to see, to go back a little bit and talk about the pandemic, because at the beginning, I think certainly in the kind of early days in late March, it was still not necessarily clear to you that everything was going to be okay, right? I mean, you had a lot of customers, some of whom were on the smaller side, startups, right? Who were suddenly trying to figure out, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? How am I going to pay my next paycheck, et cetera? Can you just walk us through what it was like at that time and when did things change? I don't know if it was a week later or 2 weeks later, but what was that moment like for your company?
In one word, scary, right? And I remember this distinctly because at the time, our cash in the bank was probably around 2 million or so. I remember looking in our MIS, and I remember how I feel. I remember how I felt when I went with my wife to Costco and we'd see all these empty shelves, right? Like the no toilet paper, no hand sanitizers, like that craziness that existed, right? It felt very apocalyptic. It was a scary time for everyone. I remember there were some investor conversations I would have, and everyone was, a good chunk of people were going into bunker mode, right? Traveling overseas, traveling to other countries. It was a scary time. And I remember really worrying first about the health and well-being of my team. It's very sad. Like we lost people. We had a Turing team member pass away due to COVID. We were genuinely scared for the health of our team. The second was looking at our customer base, we worried how much of our customers would make it, the smaller customers in particular. And that period lasted at least, I would say, 3 months from starting like, say, March or something like that. And I remember in every single one of my investor updates, I would share, hey, medium to longer term, we are optimistic, but short term, we are being extremely cautious because we were scared of collections risk as well. Like, would some of our customers not be able to pay their bills? But what happened, which I couldn't have guessed, is that our revenues and customer adoption just kept growing. It never skipped a beat. Like month over month, we were growing. If you look at our graph, you couldn't tell that there was a lockdown in March or at that time period. We just kept on growing. And our revenues picked up. We had a lot more investors also come in. But to be perfectly honest, like we just did not know that it could have gone in so many different ways. And I just feel fortunate that in the longer term, like things worked out okay, but it was a very scary time and a very uncertain time.
Yeah. And obviously we spoke around that time because it was very clear that a company like yours was incredibly well positioned. Once it became clear that, you know, the world would go on and business would continue just in a new way. It was pretty clear that you were doing something that was even more relevant than it was before. And it was already quite relevant. So what was the, you know, in terms of the important customers or the kinds of customers that you then held up as examples to be able to get more business, what you know, was the first early customer that was really important to your growth?
VillageMD and Plume were important early customers for us. And I'll always be thankful to them since they took a bet on Turing at a time when we were a lot smaller. So those are some big customers that were very helpful. Later on, Coinbase, Johnson & Johnson were also big anchor customers. Rivian has also been like a really good customer for us, and that's been helpful. We for some reason, we were also very popular with Series A, Series B startups that were rapidly growing, like these companies that needed engineers really fast, like where not having the right engineer in the right role is 1 month of burn that's incorrectly allocated. Every month that you don't have the right person in the team, it's not ideal. So we're fortunate to have some good companies in that segment.
So when you started the company around 2018, it's not as if there weren't other talent marketplaces out there. And I think one of the reasons we started to talk is I was also looking into TopTal, which is another marketplace. It really seemed like you were trying to be much more careful in the kind of talent that you were vetting and having, you know, quite rigorous vetting processes, and that's something that you were hoping to kind of automate over time, as well as managing people after they are hired, not just bringing people in the door to your customers, but making sure they have ways to keep those people accountable. Tell us a little bit about that and talk about what you hope to automate further as you scale.
We are very different from a lot of the marketplace companies that are out there. We're actually not a marketplace. Many people think we are, but we're not. So our vision is that we now live in a remote-first world, and every company today is in a race to reap the benefits of remote engineering talent. LinkedIn's going remote, Twitter's going remote, even traditional companies like Siemens and Ford are going remote. But remote is hard. It's hard for three big reasons. First, it's really hard to build a global pipeline of truly great engineers at scale. If you're a VP of engineering, how are you going to build a pipeline of tens of thousands of Golang engineers from Sao Paulo or thousands of Java engineers from Croatia? Right? So building a global pipeline is hard. And second, when you are evaluating the global engineering talent pool, you are not going to recognize Stanford, Berkeley in their educational background. You're not going to see Google, Facebook, Stripe in their work experience. These are great engineers, but nothing in their resume is going to stand out to you. So you have to interview them. And how are you going to interview these tens of thousands of global engineers from this global engineering talent pool without sucking up all of your engineering team's time? So evaluating this global engineering talent pool is hard. And finally, Amir, to your point, this is a big area of differentiation, which is after you've found that perfect engineer, if you ask an engineering manager, what's the hardest thing about working with a remote developer? I mean, if you ask them, I would say 90% of the time, they would say communication. Communication is hard because time zones are hard. And sometimes security is also a point of concern. Often the right kind of daily communication, weekly communication, performance management doesn't happen. So building a giant global pipeline is hard. Evaluating a global pipeline of engineers is hard. And ongoing management of that engineering pool is hard, right? And the traditional solutions like weren't really built for this. Like if you look at a headhunting firm or a staffing firm, they don't have global reach. Most of the time, all you get is tons and tons of resume spam, as most founders know. And if you look at these recruiting marketplaces, and there are plenty of marketplaces, including some of the ones that you mentioned, the challenge with those marketplaces is often they are more suited for gig workers and who are looking for small-time gigs, nights and weekends, not people committed to a full-time job. And many of these marketplaces don't do any kind of vetting for engineers. And finally, if you look at these IT services companies, like the TCS, Wipro, Infosys, Accenture, they don't have Silicon Valley caliber talent. And they are also not set up to take advantage of the global talent pool. They can take advantage of a pool in Bangalore or a pool in Belarus, but they can't really tap into the global talent pool. So we asked ourselves a simple question. What if we could replace all of this with software? What if we had software that could source engineers planet-wide? What if we had software that could evaluate engineers to a Silicon Valley bar automatically and objectively? What if we had software that could match the best engineers with the best jobs with AI? What if we had software that could solve for all of the communication security issues, software that could solve for compliance? And this is why we built Turing. Turing's creating a new category, and we call this category Talent Cloud, where we want to make it easy for you to spin up your engineering dream team in the cloud as easily as you'd spin up servers on Amazon.
Yeah, and I think when we talked before the pandemic, you even had people in sub-Saharan Africa, I think, was one region where you were able to find talent that was working for your customers as well. Do you have examples of engineers who have stayed with one company for a long time, or is that not the goal? Is it possible for some of them to become like full-time employees essentially, or is that not really anyone's goal here?
So we have engineers who've been with companies for a very long time. Like for the typical model, like we aim for like 1 to 3 years. There are also cases where the engineer was so integral to the company that the company essentially takes the engineer off of Turing and brings them onto their team. And we've done that.
And you're okay with that? You're okay with that?
We're 100% okay with that when it's good for the engineer and it's good for the company. Like we're playing the long game here. Like for us, when an engineer is happy and they tell their friends that Turing changed their lives, it's good for us. And these engineers who become embedded in these companies become the kind of people who open the doors for Turing in the future. When they become an engineering manager and they need to hire, like who are they gonna call? So we feel proud to have played a small role in their success.
So it's kind of like Match.com, where you pay a subscription, but if you get married, you're not a subscriber anymore, but then you tell everyone you met on Match and it goes on.
That's a great analogy. That's exactly right.
Your team is fully distributed, of course. Where is everyone located? How many people do you have? And are you planning to bring people together physically at any point?
Our team is fully distributed. We are about 400 people now from about 30 different countries. We bring people together all the time. Like we highly encourage meetups in person. So different groups and teams all over the world have met. I have a crazy goal, and I scare our head of HR and finance when I tell them this, but the crazy goal is to bring everyone together in one location sometime next year. It's going to be a logistical challenge to do that, and we might have to take over some hotel, hopefully, assuming, of course, COVID and safety protocols, like we're able to solve for that. So we do want to bring everyone together because I think there is this magic and energy that you have when you meet in person. So I'm a big believer in work from anywhere, but meet as needed.
Well, there are now startups to do that you just described, to help you, your company, you're the customer, to bring everyone together in a location that makes sense and logistically coordinate. And one company you should ask who did this before the pandemic is Webflow, which did bring everyone together. I think in Hawaii it was for, it must have been hundreds of people even at the time. So fantastic to hear from you about what you're building, and really appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Amir. Appreciate you having me and helping us unleash the world's untapped human potential.
Thanks for listening to The Information's 411. And thanks again to Kevin McLaughlin and Jonathan Siddharth for talking to me. This episode was produced by Spoke Media. From Spoke, producer Cody Hoffmackel, coordinating producer Alicia Force, mixing and mastering engineer Will Short, associate producer Lucy Wong, and executive producer Keith Reynolds. From The Information, Anne Marinovich and Becky Eventash. I'm Amir Efrati. Have a great weekend, everyone.